is.
Ms. Williams?
May it please the court. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak about this subject today. I wanted to start, Mr. Young is appealing on two counts today. He was sentenced in a court in Kansas City to cumulatively 20 years in prison. That was 15 years for the felon in possession of the firearm with the mandatory minimum with the ACCA plus an additional 5 years, making it a total of 20. He appeals two issues today, and I wanted to start with the one that was hardest for me to get my head around, and that's the issue of how to address racial and implicit bias in the process of a trial, and particularly in veneer.
Ms. Williams, since you're beginning with that issue, I'd like to ask a question about something that the government raised in its red brief, which is the issue of waiver. Can you address waiver, forfeiture? Where are we here?
Well, as I understand it, they claim that this issue was raised by us after the judge said, if you want me to address this issue of race with the jury, I'll do that. And then we said, okay, that's fine. I don't know that waives it, and certainly I didn't intend to waive that issue. When we went up to the bench, this was done at a bench conference, not in open court in front of the veneer panel, obviously. We went up there, I honestly wasn't expecting the judge to ask all of my questions, but I had proposed these 12 questions that were open-ended questions that were supposed to be designed to elicit some discussion, not just yes or no questions, but open-ended ones. When he said that he would address the issue of racial prejudice, it was clear to me that he wasn't going to go into the weeds of this issue like I wanted it to. So I said, that's fine, you can do that. But then what he said, I think, turned out and maybe to have made the situation slightly worse, because the way he addressed it was a way that I don't think anybody would ever elicit a positive response out of. Essentially, he said,
"Well, counsel, did you follow up and suggest additional questions after that?"
I didn't, and the reason I didn't is because at that point I felt like that there was some hostility about this issue, and I didn't want to alienate the judge anymore related to this for my client.
Well, you could have made a record at least, right? I mean.
Right.
As I understand it, your argument is there's a significant difference between what I would call generally explicit bias or overt racial bias and implicit bias. And if the judge addressed the former,
right,
and you are arguing on appeal that the latter issue should have been addressed, I just don't see anywhere where the district court was put on notice that it had failed to do something that you wanted it to do.
I mean, other than the fact that I wrote these questions about the implicit bias, and we had the bench meeting where I said, look, I'd really like to, if you don't want to address the address the veneer panel with these questions that I presented, I'm happy to do that. But I would like some voir dire about implicit bias. And what he said, and maybe I just didn't understand him at the time, was I'm happy to address the issue of racial bias. And then the way it was done was obviously not the way that we had intended. And also, I think, a way that was pretty ineffective. I mean, just saying, does anybody here think that because this defendant is African-American, they won't be able to be fair? I think it's unrealistic to expect anybody, even someone who has overt racist feelings towards people of color, to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to be the person that I'm not going to be able to be fair. So,
Ms. Williams, how does voir dire work in your district? It looks like the district court judge did, 99% of it. Is that procedure there, that the lawyers don't have a set amount of time to ask their own set of questions?
It really depends on the judge. There's some of the judges that will allow anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes after the judge has finished doing the questioning to allow the counsel to address the panel if they want to. Usually that's worked out beforehand, whether or not someone's going to ask any questions, but there's some judges that allow it and some judges that don't. So there's not something that's like a blanket rule.
Is there any kind of local rule or local expectation that you should request that if you have a particular topic that you want to explore with the jury?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if there's any sort of local rule. The way that we do it, you know, is we submit these questions, and then when we have our pretrial meeting to discuss everything, the judge asks about these, you know, the questions that we submitted, and then asks if they're going to allow counsel to present, asks if we want to present or if we're going to want to present or if the judge is going to do all of it. So I don't think there's anything official is what I'm saying.
So counsel, just to cut to the chase, wouldn't Rosales-Maris have to be overruled in order for you to prevail?
You know, it might have to be. And that is an issue. And, you know, like I said in my brief, and one of the reasons that I wanted to start with this is because this is a hard issue to address. It's a hard issue to talk about, and it's a hard issue to address, and it's a hard issue to address in a courtroom setting. But it is something that I think that is very important. The way Judge Bennett described it, you know, there's a constitutional standard, like when the Constitution requires that this be, that racial prejudice be addressed, like if that's one of the main driving forces of the trial, or if that's a, you know, a big issue in the trial. But the other one has to do with like perception. And the fact is that my client and most of my clients of color have had very different experiences with the criminal justice system than I have, or that most of, you know, my white friends have. And he felt very strongly that this was a racist stop. And because of that, he wanted to make sure that the jury that was sitting in judgment of him, you know, we can't just say don't be prejudiced and suck all the prejudice out of everybody's head. But it does. Nobody wants to be thought of as racist, and nobody wants to be thought of as there's someone that has biases against people. But when you bring up these issues, it causes people to think hard about it and make sure they you know, judge the evidence in a way that they're not.
I'm wondering, is your view that district courts should be required to address implicit bias limited to race situations, or would it apply more broadly if we were to accept your argument? In other words, if a defendant was a particular a group of any particular, you know, disadvantaged group, right? In other words, under your argument, would a district court have to get into an implicit bias against, for example, Jews, or against women, or against homosexuals? I mean, in other words, in any case, is there any upfront showing that has to be made first before a district court has to do this, or any time a defendant thinks there may be an implicit bias, is a district court obligated, if the defendant feels, as you just indicated, your client did, and I don't doubt that, in any case, then, is any implicit bias required to be addressed?
You know, I honestly think that it is. I mean, I don't see one of the government's arguments is that this would have just taken too long. And, you know, my clients are facing years and years and years in prison. My client in this particular case is almost 60, and he got a 20-year sentence. That could very well be that he spends the rest of his life in prison on this. You know, having a couple questions, and maybe the way I went about it isn't the best way to do it, but this is something I think that we need to be thinking about and putting in the forefront of our minds when we're doing these cases. And you know, maybe it could be done like with the video that, for example, the Washington court plays, or a jury instruction about implicit bias, or allowing counsel to conduct a little bit, a limited voir dire about this issue. But yeah, I think if there is a chance, or if the defendant is feeling like this case is stacked against them already, inquiring about whether or not people feel a way, a certain way or another about whatever group that the defendant is, you know, it makes, and I see that I'm out of time, so I'll wrap up. I apologize. It makes for more confidence in our system that we are trying to be fair, and we are trying to recognize that some people have a different playing field than other people. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Mr. Wagner.
Thank you, Judge Kelly, and may it please the court, David Wagner for the United States. I'll just start briefly with the topic of waiver, which I think was, I don't have a lot more to say on that. I think Judge Kobus hit the nail on the head when he pointed out that based on the colloquy with the district court, there's really no way for the district court to know that what he had done, what he proposed to do and then did, was in any way inadequate for what the defense wanted in this case. And I think that's the key.
Counsel, it seems to me that dialogue was rather vague. Is it possible that counsel misunderstood what the district court was going to do? And was there any opportunity to object after that?
Well, just to take the first part of the question, I don't actually find it vague, Judge Braz. I think the district court explained very clearly that there can be questions about implicit bias on the one hand, or there can be questions about race. His proposal was to ask a question about race, and to that, defense counsel said, okay, that would be great. So I think it was pretty clear what he was proposing to do. And to the second part of your question about an opportunity to object, obviously the district court didn't turn to counsel and say, was that good enough? But I think the discussion that had happened made it incumbent upon defense counsel to at that point interject and say something, even if the district court didn't explicitly say, you know, does that address the questions that you wanted me to ask?
Mr. Wagner, I have a follow-up question about the colloquy. I think that you are referencing where the district court does distinguish. He's saying Ms. Williams asks for a little bit of voir dire about race, and he says, well, all right, there are race questions and there are implicit bias questions, right? She says, yes. And he says, I'll be happy to broach the subject of race. I guess another way you could look at that is it's an implicit denial of her request for implicit bias questions, and then it's preserved.
Oh, I don't read it that way at all. I think the court was offering essentially a compromise or suggesting a compromise. And I think there's also the issue of the response there. It wasn't, to continue to say, well, I would also like some implicit bias questions, but to say that would be great. I don't know how to read that other than an acceptance of what the district court was proposing to do. But let me move on unless there's other questions about waiver, I'd like to move on and get to into the merits of this issue, because I think the fundamental disagreement here between the defense and the government in this case is that the government doesn't think that the defense's position accounts for all the safeguards that we have at trial to protect against the risk of bias, whether it be racial bias, gender bias, religious bias, any sorts of bias like that. And I think those safeguards were very important to the Supreme Court in Rosales-Lopez, that one of the two reasons the Supreme Court found there was no reasonable possibility of racial prejudice in that case was because the district court had asked a question about aliens. And therefore, the Supreme Court said that would cover the concern about bias towards Mexicans.
Mr. Wagner, here are we sort of in a different world altogether? I don't mean literally world, but world of biases. I think that the Supreme Court, and traditionally we've talked about, when we said bias, we're talking about explicit biases that the courts have said, look, you know, instructions that address that directly, that's good. You know, juries are going to listen to that and don't know what else we can do. But implicit bias just seems to be a different animal altogether in some ways, even though it's still bias. And I'm just wondering how much we can rely on the explicit bias cases and instructions to get at something that I think the research is saying we all have, and it may not even be something that is a for cause a strike for someone, but it's something that is there that defendants want to talk about. Can you address that distinction if you also see one?
Yeah, I think there may be a little bit of a distinction there. I still think that the case law about that deals with explicit bias or seems to deal with explicit bias, I'm not sure it exactly distinguishes between the two. I still think that's a useful framework, but I do understand your point, and that's why I want to go back to the point about safeguards in the case, because I don't think implicit bias is so much an issue of getting jurors to admit that they're biased. And I think it's often called unconscious bias, so I'm not entirely sure anyone... I think the idea is you can't necessarily recognize that you have it. It's there and it causes you to have certain reactions, but you don't recognize you have it. But the way to address that is not necessarily to get people to admit it, but to make sure there's other safeguards in place. So to ask them, can you commit to deciding this case not based on anything that you know or that you're any preconceptions that you have, but based only on the evidence and the law I give you? Asking jurors, can you separate yourself from the news? And, you know, don't worry, don't think about all the things that you've heard in the news that might impact the way you think about this case and then may contribute to whatever biases, implicit biases that you harbor within yourself, but only focus on the evidence in this case. Can you reserve decision until you've had an opportunity to talk with your fellow jurors and deliberate?
You said something. Did you add the phrase implicit bias in the instruction you were just summarizing? Not rely on any implicit biases you may have?
I don't know if I did or not, actually. Certainly, I didn't mean to imply that was said at trial.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask, if that was actually in the instructions. I didn't think it was, but I wanted to make sure I understood the record.
You're absolutely correct. The words implicit bias were not in the instruction. The exact instruction was, quote, to not allow sympathy or prejudice to influence you. The law demands of you a just verdict, unaffected by anything except the evidence. Your common sense is the law I give it to you, and the law as I give it to you. And of course, it doesn't say the words implicit bias, but it's reminding the jurors and encouraging them, don't think, you know, don't act on your preconceptions. Don't act on sympathy or prejudice. Think about the facts. Think about the law I give you. And then also, very importantly, and the Supreme Court has recognized that this is critical safeguard against the risk of bias among jurors, which is to reserve decision until full deliberation. And that deliberative process, talking about it with fellow jurors rather than coming to, you know, a knee-jerk reaction based on some evidence that you see in the case, I think that's a very important safeguard against the risk of jurors basing a verdict on their implicit or unconscious biases. So all those things, although they don't use the words implicit bias, and maybe those safeguards were put in place at a time before, you know, this was this concern was at the forefront of jurists' minds, I think they all address exactly this issue and protect against it. And I think that's also why these studies of how some people have reacted to situations that involve a racial element in findings that some people have found people of a different race more guilty than if the fact pattern is presented as somebody of another race. I think that's why those are very unpersuasive in this context, because those people didn't receive these instructions. They didn't hear evidence in the solemn setting of a courtroom. They didn't take an oath to abide by the court's instructions. They didn't deliberate with fellow jurors. They were just coming up with thoughts off the top of their heads. And that's exactly what we want to guard against in trials. And that's exactly why courts give these sorts of instructions. I'd like to address just very briefly, Judge Graz's point about whether the defense position in this case would require overruling Rosales-Lopez. And admittedly, Rosales-Lopez doesn't involve implicit bias specifically, but I think the framework there is the question is whether race is an issue in the case, such that there's a reasonable probability that a jury can be impacted by racial bias. And we know that because the example is a violent crime involving a victim and perpetrator of different races. To take Rosales-Lopez and say there's a reasonable probability in any case that involves a minority defendant, I think would really turn that precedent on its head. And I don't think it can be consistent with that precedent. I would also point out that the Supreme Court said in Rosales-Lopez, and I'm quoting, "There's no constitutional presumption of juror bias for or against members of any particular racial or ethnic groups." It seems to me that the per se rule that the defendant is asking for creates just that presumption. I see I'm out of time. I'd be happy to answer any more questions, but otherwise would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Does Ms. Williams have any rebuttal time left? Do you need a minute to respond, or would you like to stand on your main argument?
If I could just have 1 minute, I just want to respond to one thing. I think, and while we all want to feel like what the government said is 100% true, by being in a court and being solemn and having the judge say you can't have this other stuff affect you, everybody wants to think that they are going to be fair and they are not going to let that stuff happen. And I think that most people would say, oh, well, I'm absolutely not thinking this person is guilty because he's black. That's not what I'm talking about. All the cases related to this were done in the 80s and the 70s. And there's a different mindset now. Race is much more of a forefront of an issue. We have recognized systematic racism within our courts and our policing system as something that exists. And we need to do a better job addressing it, particularly for our defendants of color who are facing the rest of their life in prison. I think asking a few questions to elicit this isn't something that is too much to ask. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments in the case and for your briefing, and we'll take the matter under advisement.